believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
My fellow citizens,
your enemy is ruling your country, and war is what they got.
It was the largest bank failure in U.S. history.
Americans are concerned about the adjustments that are taking place in our financial markets.
And people are working harder, but still falling behind.
People said, are you optimistic? I said, absolutely.
There was blood on the floor at the end of trading on Wall Street today.
A financial tsunami.
One of the ugliest days I have ever seen.
Absolutely optimistic.
Nightmare on Wall Street.
The atomic bomb.
Almost Armageddon.
A 9 on the Richter scale.
Something of a financial hurricane hitting the United States today.
Absolutely optimistic. His optimism is absolute. It is total. There are no mixed indicators.
Price of homes, they fell again, a record, 16.3% according to the...
Yet another giant lender was taken over.
Greed is rewarded. Excess is rewarded.
Recent economic indicators have become increasingly mixed.
They have a gun pointed at their head, and they're trying to tell us that if we don't give them $700 billion, they're going to pull the trigger.
Nor is people asking the question of what does all of this mean for me?
There's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down. And the rich have won.
In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in.
The war is going well enough that there's no need to end it. And just as importantly, it's not going well enough that there's any possibility of ever ending it.
2/3 of Americans say it's not worth fighting.
So?
So? You don't care what the American people think?
No.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere. Nope, no weapons over there.
Right, you're not saying they out and out lied, Michelle.
No, I mean, what do we know? What do you think? I don't know.
These are revolutionary times.
You don't say that out loud.
I prescribe the treatment of a radical revolution within our nation from that of a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented community.
We must be prepared to match actions with words. By seeking out every creative method of protest possible.
For the past 30 years, the productivity of American workers has increased by 76%. But their real hourly wages have risen less than 2%.
Even a worker in the lowest paying position has a right to get by and support a family with a good union job.
So the paradox is that people are working harder, but still falling behind.
I asked Congress to appropriate additional money to protect corporate America and to punish American workers.
But I have a fundamental belief in the goodness and strength of the American worker.
I think Senator McCain and I agree for the most part on...
How much can you really trust what a CEO says?
And when the American president speaks, it's really important for those words to mean...
Bolshevism! Sheer Bolshevism!
Change has to come from below.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us.
To ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, and thereby remove yourself from the struggle between right and wrong and good and evil. Let us be aware that while they predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world.
My interest is in terrorism in its broadest sense, because the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize.
The Dow Industrial fell 500 points.
And to terrorize is to deny people their freedom. Anyone looking at the attack today can see that it was well organized, well financed.
Following the largest bankruptcy in American history, Lehman Brothers collapsed after 158 years. Fellow financial giant Merrill Lynch were saved from the scrap heap with the Bank of America buyout. But don't worry, Lehman's commercial real estate is insured by the massive American International Group, better known as Notorious AIG, which today...
Terrorism is something that is not done cheaply, and funds will be required.
What's that? Nearly collapsed. Why? Because AIG actually sought to solve their financial problems, seriously, by lending money to themselves.
And funds will be required.
Is anybody buying this polished turd?
America, take the word of a madman.
There comes a time when the operation of the machine is so odious that you cannot even tacitly participate. You've got to place your bodies on the gears, the wheels, all the mechanism, and you've got to indicate to those who own it and those who run it that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Good evening and welcome to Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with an international revolutionary socialist perspective. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. Thanks for tuning in this week. On this week's edition, we'll be speaking, of course, about Gaza, but we'll also be speaking, this being the first show after the Obama inauguration, of the continuance of American imperialism in our time, especially when looked at through the lens of the response to Gaza. We'll also talk about free market fantasies as illustrated by New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. We have author Gary Lapon with an insightful article on that. And as well, Gaza. Please stay tuned while we remember our brothers and sisters in Palestine. I'm going to go ahead and play for you this next tune, and we'll dedicate it to the newly confirmed handmaiden of American imperialism, Hillary Clinton. Stay tuned to Seeing Red Radio.
Every generation needs a new revolution. And I realize that our generation is at the starting place for this revolution. We know where to start. The president calls them his base. We must call them our enemies. A country born out of defiance against tyranny must continue to defy it at every turn. The time is now.
American woman, stay away from me. American woman, mama, leave me be. Don't come hanging around my door. Don't want to see your face no more. Got more important things to do than spend my time going back with you. Now, woman, I said stay away. American woman, listen what I say. American woman, get away from me. American woman, mama, let me be. Don't come knocking around my door. Don't want to see you push no more. Color lines can't hypnotize. Sparkle someone else's eyes. Now, woman, I said get away. American woman, listen what I say.
I call you the elite. I call you my base. Do it. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
Poke out someone else's eyes. Now, woman,
It would have helped if Obama had the courage to talk about what everyone in the Middle East was talking about. No, it wasn't the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. They knew about that. They expected the beginning of the end of Guantanamo, and the probable appointment of George Mitchell as a Middle East envoy was the least that was expected. Of course, Obama did refer to quote-unquote slaughtered innocents, but these were not quite the slaughtered innocents the Arabs had in mind. There was the phone call yesterday to Mahmoud Abbas. Maybe Obama thinks he's the leader of the Palestinians, but as every Arab knows, except perhaps Mr. Abbas, he is the leader of a ghost government, a near corpse only kept alive with the blood transfusion of international support and the full partnership Obama has apparently offered him, whatever full means. And it was no surprise to anyone that Obama also made the obligatory call to the Israelis. But for the people of the Middle East, the absence of the word Gaza, indeed, the word Israel as well, was the dark shadow over Obama's inaugural address. Didn't he care? Was he frightened? Did Obama's young speechwriter not realize that talking about black rights while a black man's father might not have been served in a restaurant 60 years ago would concentrate Arab minds in the fate of a people who gained the vote only 3 years ago, but were then punished because they voted for the wrong people? It wasn't a question of the elephant in the china shop. It was the sheer amount of corpses headed up on the floor of the china shop. Sure, it's easy to be cynical. Arab rhetoric has something in common with Obama's cliches: hard work and honesty, courage and fair play, loyalty and patriotism. But however much distance the new president put him between himself and the vicious regime he was replacing, 9/11 still hung like a cloud over New York. He had to remember, quote, the firefighters' courage to storm a stairway filled with smoke, end quote. Indeed, for Arabs, the, quote, our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred, end quote, was pure Bush. The one reference to, quote unquote, terror, the old Bush and Israeli fear word, was a worrying sign that the new White House still hasn't got the message. Hence, we had Obama apparently talking about Islamist groups such as the Taliban, who are, quote unquote, slaughtering innocents, but who, quote unquote, cannot outlast us. As for those in the speech who are corrupt and who, quote unquote, silence dissent, presumably intended to be the Iranian government, most Arabs would associate this habit with President Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, who also, of course, received a phone call from Obama yesterday, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, and a host of other autocrats and head choppers who are supposed to be America's friends in the Middle East. Hanan Ashrawi got it right. The changes in the Middle East, justice for the Palestinians, security for the Palestinians as well as for the Israelis, an end to the illegal building of settlements for Jews and Jews only on Arab land, an end to all violence, not just the Arab variety, had to be immediate, she said at once. But if the gentle George Mitchell's appointment was meant to answer this demand, the inaugural speech, a real quote-unquote B-minus in the Middle East, did not. The friendly message to Muslims, quote, a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect, end quote, simply did not address the pictures of the Gaza bloodbath at which the world has been staring in outrage. Yes, the Arabs and many other Muslim nations, and of course, most of the world, can rejoice that the awful Bush has gone. So too, Guantanamo. But will Bush's torturers and Rumsfeld's torturers be punished? Or quietly promoted to a job where they don't have to use water and cloths and listen to men screaming? Sure. Give the man a chance. Maybe George Mitchell will talk to Hamas. He's just the man to try. But what will the old failures, such as Dennis Ross, have to say, and Rahm Emanuel, and indeed Robert Gates and Hillary Clinton? More a sermon than an Obama inaugural. Even the Palestinians in Damascus spotted the absence of those two words, Palestine and Israel. So hot to touch they were, and on a freezing Washington day, Obama wasn't even wearing gloves. That was an article by Robert Fisk from The Independent. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Freedom is the universal gift of Almighty God.
The God-given promise that all are equal, all are free.
We will work with our friends and allies across the world to defend our way of life.
We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense.
We can usher in a new era of enhanced prosperity and peace.
America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace.
Did our generation advance the cause of freedom?
We carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations.
A Palestinian tragedy broadcast live on Israeli television. A call to a doctor in Gaza who's been reporting daily for an Israeli station. His three daughters have just been killed. They've killed his family, he says. I think I'm a bit overwhelmed too. He then explains that Dr. Abul Aish is a Palestinian physician who's worked for years at an Israeli hospital. Who was hurt, he asks. He has 8 children, the journalist explains. Maybe we can do something to help. Abul Aish, where is your house? The cameras then follow the journalist as he tries to use his contacts to send ambulances to help the survivors. Incredibly, he succeeds. The Israeli army allows a Palestinian ambulance to go straight to the Eretz border crossing. From there, the injured are transferred onto Israeli ambulances and taken to Israeli hospitals. Among them, one of the daughters who survived. For the most part of this 22-day war, Israeli journalists were not allowed to report from inside Gaza. And Dr. Abul Aish, a Hebrew speaker, was one of the rare voices bringing the reality of the Palestinian suffering into the Israeli living rooms.
Everybody in Israel knows that I was talking on television and on the radio, that we are at home, that we are innocent people. Suddenly today, when there was hope for ceasefire, on the last day I was talking to my children, suddenly they bombed us. Is that how you treat a doctor who takes care of Israeli patients? Is that what's done? Is this peace?
The Israeli army said a tank shelled the doctor's house in response to sniper fire coming from the building. Eyewitnesses denied that. Many Israeli viewers called the station to give the doctor their support, moved by the tragedy of one father made real by the power of live television. But over 90% of the Israelis still support the war on Gaza, while hundreds of other tragedies remain just a number in a rising Palestinian death toll. Rose Ibrahimova, Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera is reporting the current assessment of damage in Gaza. 20,000 commercial buildings partially or completely destroyed, 4,000 homes completely destroyed, and more than 100,000 people homeless. Those quote-unquote Hamas militants must have been everywhere to justify that kind of damage. Sure they were. By the way, those infamous incidents of attacks of the UN headquarters and a UN school, just the tip of the iceberg. The UN is reporting that a total of 53 installations used by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, were damaged or destroyed during Israel's Gaza campaign, including 37 schools, 6 of which are being used as emergency shelters, 6 health centers, and 2 warehouses. You probably won't be surprised that while Al Jazeera is reporting this concrete news, the New York Times main article, judging from the website, takes a different "it's all about us" tack. Quote, "On Palestinian question, tough choices for Obama," end quote. The Washington Post does better. Quote, "As constraints on Gaza ease, new reports of misery," end quote. Actually highlighting some individual atrocities, albeit while noting that they could not be independently verified, and noting the total damage estimate of $2 billion, but without the shocking and staggering statistics noted above. The Post also reports, as is pretty much the norm in the U.S. press, that about 1,300 Palestinians and 13 Israelis died, without noting that of those 13, only 3 were civilians, and about half of the rest were actually killed by Israelis in friendly fire. This may seem like a minor issue, but the difference between thinking that Palestinians killed 13 Israelis and only 3 Israeli civilians is to state the obvious, to imply that Palestinians killed 4 times as many Israeli civilians as they actually did. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio.
That watchtower is 200 yards away in Egypt. This side of the border was Israel's target number one. Its F-16s hit Rafah hard. This boy is standing in a massive crater. Israel's prime military objective, destroy the tunnels through which Hamas imports its Qassam rockets. There are reckoned to be 2,000 tunnels, and the bombs did wreck a lot of them. But the very day the Israelis announced their full withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, Rafah's tunnelers got back to work.
Well, the tunnel repair teams are in action and the structural engineers have moved in. They're trying to get things up and running again here in Rafah. Just in behind the green sheeting over there, there's a tunnel which has been completely obliterated by the bombing, and there's buildings all over this area which have been very, very heavily hit by the bombs. But despite this, there are still tunnels here completely unscathed, including this one, which is up and running.
It's not just guns and rockets that come through here. These tunnels are a lifeline for Gaza's 1.5 million people. Through them come sheep and goats and fruit and veg, generators, fridges, motorbikes and diesel. Last year, they even stocked Rafah Zoo by pulling through an anesthetized crocodile, 3 lion cubs and monkeys.
God willing, we will not give Israel a chance to destroy the tunnels or to destroy us. We are forced to use them to bring food because of the siege of Gaza. You have no idea how dangerous it is. Every day we face death, but each one of us is working to feed our families.
Still close to the frontier, but 100 yards back down the street, people's homes did not escape Israel's overwhelming firepower. I found a group of children sitting on the front steps of the family home.
When we came back, everything was gone. We were all crying. We didn't have time to move anything out of the house. Everything is gone, even my school bag.
We left Rafah and headed northeast along the rubble and debris-strewn roads towards an area called Qazar. Here, the Gaza Strip is at its widest, but that's just 8 miles wide. This was one of Israel's main land invasion routes.
This is about as far east as you can get in the Gaza Strip, and if you look down there just beyond the trees, that is Israel. And in the very far distance, you can see some movement of military vehicles and an aircraft over there too. And when the Israelis invaded the Gaza Strip, they came straight in here. And these are the tank tracks. When they arrived here, they got first to a village called Al-Najah. This is it. And this is what they did.
More than 20 people died here, including a woman, locals told me, shot dead while waving a white flag. In total, 85 houses were completely demolished in this area. Jihad Ahmed Al-Najjar told me each building housed at least 3 large families. He started listing those now homeless.
Ibrahim Salman Al-Najjar, Hassan Abdul Aziz Al-Najjar.
The list went on and on and on. Traveling north again, a roadside Palestinian cemetery where Israeli tanks had parked up. They'd driven over graves. Some families have had to reinter their dead. By now, we were halfway up the 25-mile-long finger of semi-arid land that is the Gaza Strip. It's a jumble of cities, villages, and refugee camps, an overcrowded coastal enclave that's little more than a fenced-in Palestinian ghetto.
This is the home of the Abu Zahar family in Netzarim. In 2004, the Israeli army came and demolished their home, so they built a new one. And then, at 1 o'clock in the morning, on the 6th of January this year, the Israeli army came and visited them again. Come and have a look inside.
Oh. there was virtually nothing left to salvage. 10 people lived in here, including a disabled boy, one of whose wheelchairs was wrecked. He, too, had been forced to flee in the middle of the night.
When we leave my house and go at night in the cold...
1 o'clock in the morning?
Oh, yes, yes. I took my baby, Muhammad, and Khalid, and Sarah, and my husband, and the tanks was here. And we leave the house and walk. There
no car.
When we go out the house, we don't know where we go. We walk in the dark, and they shot. They was shooting. Bombing and at night. My kids was crying and I am crying. Why did they destroy this house? This is my house. Like they have houses, we have houses. Why? And if we don't go out the house, I think they destroy of me and of my children.
Tahani told us of a village on a nearby hill and said we should go there. It's called Joharadik, or it was. Until this morning, Israeli tanks parked on a nearby ridge made it impossible to get here. What we found was breathtaking. A village wiped off the map. One man later said to me, the people who did this never want peace. 4 people died here, all women, shot. Having bulldozed the place, the Israelis destroyed the village water tower. The only houses left standing were those the occupying troops had camped in, or positioned snipers in.
Our camera cannot hope to convey the enormity of the destruction here in Joharadik. I've covered earthquakes, hurricanes, and the tsunami. And what has happened here is as bad or worse than anything I've seen in any of those. And this was done by Israeli bulldozers.
If you can take it, there's worse to come. Zaytun, a few miles north, also flattened by Israeli bulldozers. But in this house, they'd herded 100 members of the Samuni clan. And then they shelled it, killing 49 of them. The mass funeral wake is in its final day. In the house they'd occupied, Israeli soldiers left some writing on the wall. Gaza, here we are, one read. You can run, but you can't hide. Make war, not peace. Arabs need to die. Israel's main military objective in what they called the war in Gaza was ending rocket smuggling and re-establishing deterrence. What we witness today represents just a fraction of what's been meted out to the Palestinians of Gaza. This was a hopelessly lopsided war of violent subjugation. The intention was to make Israel more secure, but in Gaza, where half the population's under 15, this war has stoked even greater hatred in yet another generation. Jonathan Miller, Channel 4 News, Gaza.
You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. On tonight's edition, as you have probably already heard, we are remembering Gaza. We'll also talk before the show is up. We'll remember this particular day in history, in revolutionary history, at the times when people rose up and took power for themselves. We'll also remember the times, unfortunately, when great mass of people who fight for their rights were shot down or thwarted. You're listening to Seeing Red. I want to move on right now to an article by Eric Hobsbawm, the great British historian, recently published in the London Review of Books on the current situation in Gaza. For 3 weeks, barbarism has been on show before a universal public, which has watched, judged, and with few exceptions, rejected Israel's use of armed terror against the 1.5 million inhabitants blockaded since 2006 in the Gaza Strip. Never have the official justifications for invasion been more patently refuted by the combination of camera and arithmetic, where the news speak of military targets by the images of bloodstained children in burning schools, 13 dead on one side, 1,360 on the other, it isn't hard to work out which side is the victim. There's not much more to be said about Israel's appalling operation in Gaza, except for those of us who are Jews. In a long and insecure history as a people in diaspora, our natural reaction to public events has inevitably included the question, is it good or bad for the Jews? In this instance, the answer is unequivocally bad for the Jews. It is patently bad for the 5.5 million Jews who live in Israel and the occupied territories of 1967, whose security is jeopardized by the military actions that Israeli governments take in Gaza and in Lebanon, actions which demonstrate their inability to achieve their declared aims and which perpetuate and intensify Israel's isolation in a hostile Middle East, since genocide or the mass expulsion of Palestinians from what remains of their native land is no more on the practical agenda than the destruction of the State of Israel. Only negotiated coexistence on equal terms between two groups can provide a stable future. Each new military adventure, like the ones in Gaza and Lebanon, will make such a solution much more difficult and will strengthen the hand of the Israeli right wing and the West Bank settlers who do not want it in the first place. Like the war in Lebanon in 2006, Gaza has darkened the outlook for the future of Israel. It has also darkened the outlook for the 9 million Jews who live in the diaspora. Let me not beat about the bush. Criticism of Israel does not imply anti-Semitism, but the actions of the government of Israel occasion shame among Jews, and more than anything, they give rise to anti-Semitism today. Since 1945, the Jews inside and outside Israel have enormously benefited from the bad conscience of a Western world that has refused Jewish immigration in the 1930s before committing or failing to resist genocide. How much of that bad conscience, which virtually eliminated anti-Semitism in the West for 60 years and produced a golden era for its diaspora, is left today? Israel in action in Gaza is not the victim people of history, nor even the brave little Israel of 1948-67 mythology, a David defeating all its surrounding Goliaths. Israel is losing goodwill as rapidly as the U.S. did under George W. Bush, and for similar reasons, nationalist blindness and the megalomania of military power. What is good for Israel and what is good for the Jews as a people are evidently linked. But until there is a just answer to the Palestinian question, they are not and cannot be identical. And it is essential for Jews to say so. Those were remarks by British historian Eric Hobsbawm in the London Review of Books. His most recent book is Globalization, Democracy, and Terrorism. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back after this.
Was another Friday morning, I was among the olive trees, out looking for birds to catch, my father, his friends, and me. I had my string and net and a nimble eye there beside the farmer's field where the songbirds fly. When you're catching birds, the world disappears, and a thousand songs of autumn are all that fills your ears. They sing their songs so brightly at the dawning of the day. They fly back and forth over the fence where we must stay away. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings, listen to the wind and the songbird sings. It's so good to come here, so far from all the sound, all the shooting and the shouting and the tanks upon the ground. I just wish I could live here beside this olive grove, just me, my friends and family, and a small wood-burning stove. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings, listen to the wind and the songbird sings. Last week I caught three sparrows, it was quite a day. Now I'm bound for glory, that's what they say. I can hear them talk about me, shedding tears upon a sack. Inside there lies a child with four bullets in his back. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings, listen to the wind and the songbird sings. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings, listen to the wind and the songbird sings.
It seems that the conservative New York Times columnist Nicholas D. Kristof missed the memo that the economic crisis has exposed his neoliberal, the free market will solve everything ideology, as bankrupt. His January 15th column on the lives of the poorest of Cambodia, where sweatshops are a dream, while a good source of toilet paper, also provides an opportunity to confront neoliberalism for what it is and how it reveals the bankruptcy of capitalism in general. Kristof's argument can be summed up in a two-sentence quote. Mr. Obama and the Democrats, who favor labor standards and trade agreements, mean well, for they intend to fight back at oppressive sweatshops abroad. But while it shocks Americans to hear it, the central challenge in the poorest countries is not that sweatshops exploit too many people, but that they don't exploit enough. End quote. He argues that while those of us who oppose sweatshop labor are well-meaning and naive idealists to really improve the lives of the world's poorest people, those who survive by scavenging in landfills, we should advocate the expansion of sweatshops. This argument is supported with such gems as, quote, talk to these families in the dump and a job in a sweatshop is a cherished dream, an escalator out of poverty, the kind of gauzy, if probably unrealistic, ambition that parents everywhere often have for their children. End quote. And another quote, one of the best hopes for the poorest countries would be to build their manufacturing industries, but global campaigns against sweatshops make that less likely. End quote. By calling a job in a sweatshop a quote-unquote cherished dream, Kristof reveals how privileged and out of touch he is. By simply recycling the old neoliberal argument trumpeted by such organizations as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that free trade and quote-unquote development will end poverty and that labor unions and standards, social services like public education, health care, and food subsidies for the poor are what is holding this project back, Kristof uses his podium to attack working people. This argument states that poor countries can eventually develop into advanced countries free of poverty, which is implied in the term developing countries. This theory has been proven false after decades of quote-unquote development that has done little or worse for the masses of people in the global south. Removing barriers to trade and slashing social services has not alleviated poverty, but has deepened and spread it, and has worsened living standards for the working class as a whole in industrialized nations as well as in developing countries like Cambodia. Wages and benefits for workers in most industrialized countries, including the U.S., have stagnated or declined in recent decades. And as Eric Toussaint lays out in his book, Your Money or Your Life, following a gradual increase in quality of life in the developing countries from 1945 to 80, after 1982, quote, eruption of the debt crisis and generalization of structural adjustment policies brought on the degradation of living conditions, end quote. The capitalist class and its cronies in government around the world, not anti-sweatshop movements or the broader labor movement, are to blame for the lack of jobs in the poorest nations. Today, production is slowing on a global level because of the contradictions of capitalism itself. The credit crunch that is a major cause of the deepening economic crisis has made it impossible for many businesses to secure the loans required to keep factories running. On the demand side, workers whose living standards have been cut again and again during the three-decade-plus reign of neoliberalism have watched their sources of credit evaporate and are no longer able to afford to buy the goods those factories would have produced. Capitalists, in competition for a limited market defined not by human need but by those with the money to buy, continually seek to cut wages and increase productivity so that fewer workers produce greater amounts of goods for less wages. This undercuts demand and leads to crises of overproduction like the one we're in today. Factories close, leading to even weaker demand, and the cycle repeats itself. This is not the work of omnipotent anti-sweatshop activists. It is a tendency built into capitalism as an economic system. The growing gap between rich and poor under the late 20th and early 21st century world capitalism, both internationally and within the borders of individual nation states, has led to the tragic absurdity of unemployment due to a lack of capital in some countries, alongside unemployment due to an excess of capital in others. And internationally, the means and potential exist to meet the human needs of everyone on the planet several times over. This state of affairs underlines the relevance of Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky's century-old theory of combined and uneven development, which provides a much better analysis for understanding and changing the world today than the pipe dreams offered by apologists for capitalism. This theory argues that under capitalism, national economies do not develop in an even or straightforward manner. On the contrary, as capitalism proceeds, national markets become more and more integrated into the world economy, while development proceeds unevenly. Some countries become highly developed while others stagnate and can go backwards. And within nations, advanced production can exist side by side with some of the worst conditions imaginable for human beings, with peasants living under near feudal conditions and masses of the unemployed living off of refuse. This is a chaotic process driven by competition and the drive for greater profits for the benefit of a few at the expense of the many. The only solution, according to Trotsky, was permanent revolution, an international revolutionary movement of the working class to expropriate the exploiters who benefit from our misery and take control over production and distribution to meet the needs of all. The recent film Slumdog Millionaire, set in India and featuring images of modern skyscrapers towering above sprawling slums, strikingly illustrates the applicability of Trotsky's theory to today's world. Millions of Indians live in dire poverty, their ranks growing as farmers continue to be displaced by special economic zones, where international corporations have free rein while a few have become fabulously wealthy as a result of advanced development. Cambodia is an interesting example for Christoph to have chosen. As an American conservative pundit, Christoph is a member of a group that manages to discuss, or scapegoat, African-American poverty while minimizing or ignoring slavery, Jim Crow segregation, and institutional racism perpetrated and upheld by the U.S. ruling class. Injustices that are at the root of the high rates of poverty faced by African Americans to this day. So it's no surprise that he manages to discuss poverty in Cambodia as if it too can be torn from its historical context and dealt with without holding to account those responsible for the current state of affairs. In 1969 to 1970, in the middle of its criminal war on the Vietnamese people, the U.S. military dropped over 100,000 tons of bombs on, quote-unquote, neutral Cambodia as part of Operation Menu. The bombing killed hundreds of thousands of Cambodian civilians and paved the way for the rise of the brutal dictator Pol Pot's Khmer Rouge regime, which killed 1.5 million more. Instead of sweatshops to allow U.S. and other capitalists to exploit the survivors of this brutality and their descendants, The rich who benefit from the U.S.'s wars should be taxed, and the money used for reparations so that no Cambodian has to pick through garbage to find food to eat. More generally, a look at the history of imperialism and colonialism that continues to this day shows that the ruling classes of the U.S., Europe, and Japan, the quote-unquote triad, by far the richest in the world, built their fortunes by exploiting their own working classes while plundering, slaughtering, and exploiting those of the global South. Pathetically, remittances from immigrants working low-wage jobs are responsible for a greater flow of money from the richest nations to the global South than official aid. And the net flow of wealth is from the global South to the industrialized triad, as payments on debt and capital outflows greatly exceed any aid from the triad. The claim that employment in sweatshops should be viewed as a step up for the world's poorest is to ignore this history of injustice and to accept that a just and sane world is impossible, so that we should just settle for what little we have because, quote, it could be worse. Instead of praying for jobs in sweatshops, we must demand the reparations we are owed by our exploiters. Christoph, in a time when the rich are richer than ever and the U.S. government can find trillions of dollars to bail out the big banks, wants us to believe that the best the world's poor can expect is a chance for a sweatshop to open up in the neighborhood. In his sick version of reality, the labor movement, those who seek better wages, benefits, and working conditions for the people who produce this wealth, is portrayed not as a champion of the poor, but as an obstacle in their way. In this time of crisis, we must reject this and every other cynical ploy to weaken the only force capable of fighting back against the ruling class's attempt to make us pay for their crisis, the international working class. It is international solidarity, not sweatshops, that will improve the lives of those currently going without from Cambodia to Cairo to California. We need more of the solidarity shown by the hundreds of thousands around the world protesting the slaughter in Gaza, although they are not Gazans. They see an injury to the Palestinians is an injury to all. We need more of the solidarity exhibited by members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union who shut down the West Coast ports in the U.S. this past May 1st to protest the wars against the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and immigrants in the U.S., and were joined by Iraqi dock workers striking in their country. We need to reach back into our own history, to proud struggles like the Seattle General Strike of 1919, when workers took control of the city in a strike that halted shipments of arms being sent to crush the workers' government in Russia, so that we might learn the lessons that will enable us to move forward to a better future. That's an article by Gary LaPond, an activist and political cartoonist here in Western Massachusetts. You can find his article on the website Dissident Voice at dissidentvoice.org. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back for the last few moments of the program after this.
Yeah, roots, not talk.
Man, you are going on the roots.
No, I am.
Kind of thing called socialism in the roots.
Well, I'm going to socialize, I am.
See. Come we fight against capitalists. Come we get rid of capitalists. Come we stamp out capitalism. And make we deal with socialism. For not to trade with the rhythm. But this is socialism. For not to trade with the rhythm. Come on! And this is socialism. I said I went on a project. Crash program project. And so me see the IG them, I shoot them trouble and the double them. No come for make no trouble, so no trouble them. For them are socialists. Come on! Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on! Move ya! The rhythm. The rhythm is the rhythm. We say the rhythm is the rhythm. And the easy is the easy. For this is socialism. And not to trade with the rhythm. For not to trade with the rhythm. But this is socialism. We don't want no capitalism, as I would say. You know? A capitalist is a capturer. But a socialist only come to socialize. And you must be wise and realize.
Say me went on a project, crash program project. And so me see the IG them, I shoot them shovel and they double them. No come for make no trouble, so no trouble them. For them a socialist. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Move ya, 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 ya. Come on, brother and sister, for we are social people. We are social people.
Dillinger, right here on Seeing Red Radio. Gotta love it. Socialism here on Seeing Red. A few moments left in the program. I'd like to point out a few news items coming up this weekend for those of you in the Western Massachusetts area. Actually, on Friday evening, there is a fantastic concert going on with a host of great lefty folk singers of the type, you know, the Pete Seeger-ish type, but one of my favorites, the guy David Rovix, will be appearing. So by all means, please attend. That's in Greenfield. Look under the People's Music Network online to get information. It looks to be like an incredible show, and you absolutely, absolutely should be there. Okay, with the few moments that are left, let me just say to you all, let us remember that on this day, on January 22nd, like every day, there is history. There are moments when, again, people rose up and took control and fought their way to freedom. In 1871, Louis Michel, the famous French anarchist during the Paris Commune revolt, armed with a rifle, took her very first shot against the Breton mobiles of Trochu in front of the town hall. In 1905, on this very same day, Louis Michel was buried with a procession of over 100,000 people accompanying her coffin in the Levallois-Perret Cemetery, where she is buried. The Lepine prefect who tried to follow the procession is driven off by anarchists. Benoit Boustreau and Charles Malateau spoke at the massive gathering in the final graveside ceremony. But also on this day, in 1905, Bloody Sunday in Russia, a massacre of demonstrators in St. Petersburg. Troops opened fire on 100,000 workers, women, and children, leaving over 1,000 demonstrators dead and 3,000 wounded. It is the beginning of the very first of two Russian revolutions. And that first Soviet, later led by Leon Trotsky, was formed. In 1932, on this day, a peasant uprising occurred, which later led to the Matanza massacre of 30,000 indigenous people. In 1932, in New York City, 500 tenants battled the police and prevent eviction. In 1932 as well, Congress established the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to lend money to failing banks and other hard-hit industries. Gosh, that sounds familiar. I think we've been there before. On this day in 1967, 200 are killed by Somoza's American-trained National Guard during a protest against state violence in Managua. And in 1973, the Roe versus Wade decision was reached by the Supreme Court, of course, inspiring right-wing religious terrorists to bomb health clinics and kill people for the sanctity of human life. You've been listening to Seeing Red Radio. We're just wrapping it up. I want to point out to you, we do have a website, seeingredradio.wordpress.com. Seeing Red Radio has recently entered the podcast universe. So by all means, go to the website. You'll see a link where you can go ahead and subscribe. You can get your weekly dose of socialism. If you can't tune in, of course, to WXOJ LP 103.3 FM Valley Free Radio, streaming at valleyfreeradio.org, XOJLP, Northampton. See you next week.
Everybody and his uncle is in debt, and the bankers and the brokers are upset. Goldman Sachs's Merrill Lynch's saw themselves as lead pipe cinches. Now they've landed in the biggest screw-up yet. Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and all their kind have turned out to be the blind leading the blind. They are clearly the nitwittest in survival of the fittest. Let me modestly say what I have in mind. I am changing my name to Fannie Mae. I am changing it to AIG. On this bailout, I am betting just a piece of what they're getting would be perfectly acceptable to me. I am changing my name to Freddie Mac. I am leaving for that great receiving line. I'll be waiting when they hand out 700 million granddad. That's when I'll get mine. Since the first amphibian crawled out of the slime, we've been strongly in an unrelenting climb. We were hardly up and walking before money started talking, and it said that failure was the only crime. If you really screwed things up, then you were through. Now surprise, there is a different point of view. All that crazy Rudy tootin' and that golden parachutin' means that someone's making millions, just not you. So I'm changing my name to Fannie Mae. I am changing it to AIG. On this bailout, I am betting just a piece of what they're getting would be perfectly acceptable to me. I am changing my name to Freddie Mac. I am leaving for that great receiving line. I'll be waiting when they hand out 700 million granddad. That's when I'll get mine. I'll be waiting when they hand out 700 million grand out. That's when I'll get mine.